it's a great pleasure to be able to share in part of this day, and I'm rather sorry that I've not been able to hear more, but I have had the opportunity of looking at texts of what you heard this morning and a chance to think about those. And you've asked for a response, so that's what you're getting rather than any kind of original essay. You may be relieved. First thing I want to say, just by way of introduction, is how very much I appreciated the emphasis in Luke's presentation on the problem facing us as essentially a problem to do with the fact that we're losing sight of the political. I used to think sometimes that we ought to have a campaign for real politics. Then I thought, CRP is probably not the best acronym to work with. So if anyone can think of any alternatives, please let me know. But that is indeed, I think, where we are at the moment. A managerial problem-solving, highly interventionist, law and regulation-focused concept of government, which steers us away from some of those things which I want to come back to a bit later, that have to do with the rebalancing of imbalance in society, with the brokerage between different kinds of interests in society, and those things which seem to me to be the proper province of national government. But more of that later. You've had some discussion already today on some quite broad subjects to do with rivalry and competition and the Girardian agenda, which I think, Anne, you were talking about earlier on. You've had some discussion of sacred texts and their significance. And I want to see if I can link those themes with some of what we've been reflecting on this afternoon so far. One of the basic issues around religion, as we all know, is identity. Religion can be put in the service of people's identities in some quite destructive and malign ways occasionally, but it's also indisputably one of the deepest, most resilient, to pick up a word you've already heard today, as resilient sources of human identity that there is. And one of the challenges that we face in reflecting on all this is how the practice of religious faith becomes a deeply grounded, non-competitive, non-violent form of identity resource. How does that work? I think that's very much at the heart of some of what we've been discussing. And that's, I think, the point at which it helps to think about the role of sacred scripture. Because it seems to me that one of the ways in which people acquire identity in the practice of religious faith is in having what you might call, forgive the jargon, I'll explain it, a fixed interlocutor. There's something or someone there that you keep coming back to talk to. Something that doesn't just shift according to your own preferences or convenience. It's there, and you have elected to spend your life making sense of yourself in conversation with that. It's experienced, it's received as something given, and what that means, of course, people will disagree about no end, but it's there. It is just there. And for a good many of the religious traditions most strongly represented in this part of London and indeed in this country, scripture is the tangible way in which that fixed interlocutor comes into focus. Scripture's what you talk with. You don't talk to it, you let it talk to you. And you try and talk back a bit, and you talk to each other on the basis of it, and you find that it provides resources for talking to other people in shaping the language that you share. And so the relationship goes on, that profound engagement with the theirs of holy texts, becoming who you are through that conversation. Because one of the things about scripture that makes it both wonderful and difficult is that it doesn't just go away. You find something in the Bible, let's say, difficult. Well, you say, that's a bit difficult. And the Bible doesn't say, oh, okay, sorry, I'll just go away then. The Bible more or less says to you, get used to it, work with it, and see where you get to. Because here I am, says Scripture, and you've got to listen. You won't be surprised if I say that I don't regard that as a recipe for a kind of dogmatic biblicism, or just like rolling over with your paws in the air in the face of whatever Scripture appears to say, because that's not a real conversation. But it's there to worry you. One reason I like saying the cursing verses of the Psalms, but that's another story. Anyway, that's one point in thinking about religion and identity. And of course, having put it in that way, that also says that religiously shaped identity is a shared business. In spite of popular superstition to the contrary, people don't read the Bible or the Quran or whatever else on their own. They read it aware of other readers across the centuries, and they read it aware of other readers here and now. You can't pretend that coming to terms with sacred scripture is just something you do in the privacy of your own room. And so, in thinking about religiously shaped identity in those terms, you've actually already got some way towards not a definition, but a vision of how religiously shaped identity plays into our political and social concerns and worries these days about identity itself. If the claims of religious faith are right, truthful, then there is something about humanity, something absolutely basic and definitive about humanity, that is not just about consuming and producing. Something about being human, which is first and foremost about engagement and relation, about being challenged into life, as you might say, which I think is one of the ways you might understand revelation, being challenged into life. And I'd say that in our present climate, one of the most important things that any person of religious faith will have to say into the debates and concerns that we're in the middle of is to affirm that area of our humanity, that basic level of our humanity, which is prior to all the business of consuming and producing, and for that matter, competing. I was thinking about that in relation to the New Testament, and a rather odd idea suggested itself to me. You know that a great deal of many of the parables that Jesus tells, and a great deal of the imagery that Jesus and Paul use, is economic. There's an awful lot about money in the parables and the epistles of Paul, directly and indirectly. But the remarkable thing is that money is a metaphor. You were bought at a price, says St. Paul. Redemption, remember, is a money metaphor, long before it's a theological, technical term. Jesus talks about debts and loans and treasure buried in fields. He's very happy to use, you might say, economics as a metaphor for something else, which, if you think hard about it, suggests that economics is the secondary thing and something else is the first thing. Money exchanges are really rather good metaphors for the much more basic, comprehensive, and exciting exchanges and transformations that go on in relationships between human beings and between God and human beings. Because, you know, we use money rather a lot, money's a good metaphor. And it struck me that that is absolutely the opposite of the way in which we've been encouraged to think for a lot of the last few decades, where everything else turns out to be a metaphor for money, where the basic relationships are economic. The basic form of exchange is around producing and consuming and purchasing. And if you can't reduce other things to that, well, those other things are just kind of surface, unimportant matters. And I wonder if one of the big affirmations about biblical theology we ought to be making these days is in those terms. Instead of everything being a metaphor for economics, economics is one metaphor among others for the more basic forms of human interaction and human transformation, And I think there's, as I say, a great deal in every other page of the New Testament to suggest that that just might be the case. It relates also, of course, to the strange way in which we have been encouraged to buy into a model of humanity in which the economic motivation, desire, etc., is the one constant in human life. And some theologians and philosophers have talked about the Homo economicus model. You know, Homo sapiens is Homo economicus. Homo sapiens is the human being involved in economic affairs. But sapiens and economicus don't necessarily translate. Think about it. Think about it especially in light of the last few months, where sapiens, you know, reflective wisdom is, well, you can work out the next experience, but not the first thing you think of in connection with economics. So there we are. That's one opening thought about identity, religiously shaped identity, and particularly biblically shaped identity, and how it might play into some of these questions that we're in. But I've mentioned already that issue of competition as a factor in all this. Now, you've already, I believe this morning, had some discussion about rivalry, competition, the deep embedding in human life of the model of imitation with the twist of rivalry and competition for space that comes with that as one of those things that tragically makes us human and yet is still capable, once again through revelation, of being shifted. In thinking about interfaith affairs, it strikes me as really quite important, once again, that we should import into the discussion a recognition that the great faiths of the human family are not, if you like, jostling for the same space or bidding for the same market. And I've heard that hinted at more than once already in discussion today and what I've been reading. It's so easy to assume that when you look at a variety of religious doctrine and practice, you're looking at market competitors. The worry is, are we keeping up our market share? And rather disastrously, you can get to conceive mission just in terms of market share. I don't think that'll do. Because the great faiths are not presenting themselves as alternative jostling options in solving the same question. They present themselves as a comprehensive vision of how things are, which invite your life. And that's something a bit different from just running your finger along the shelf and saying, yeah, I think I'll have Zoroastrianism. You put it in the trolley. That, of course, doesn't mean that religious truth is an uninteresting or unimportant question. Far from it. But it does mean that religious truth, surprise, surprise, is not settled by majority votes. So that if you're losing your market share, you need to wonder if you've got your product right. Just sweep away all of that. And I think the encounter between families of religious belief and practice becomes a great deal more constructive and life-giving and enlarging in that process. You don't think of it as all these rival companies trying to get your money. But competition is deeply ingrained. Rivalry is deeply embedded in the lives we live. And the great tragedy, catastrophe, of applying that sort of language to religious faith is that it undercuts something about religious faith itself. Luke spoke earlier about limits. And I remember about 10 years ago trying to write something about this in connection with some of the historic uses of the word charity, actually. How how in the Middle Ages and the very early modern period, the word charity was used in ways which made it very clear that charity within society was one of the ways in which you limited rivalry. Charitable relationships were those that cut against endless competition, that gave you a scene of competition. And an event representing charity socially, when all the members of the trade guild went to mass together or something like that, that was the moment when everybody said, look, our relationships are not all competitive. At some point you have to say, that's enough competition, and stand together. And that's charity. And I think, essentially, the religious vision, once again, gives you every reason for thinking that there is such a place to stand. A place where you stand together, not edging against each other. Where you stand in space, territory, opened up for you by the gift of God. Not standing on the ground you have won over against somebody else with the fences up and the landmines in position. That's why I say it's somehow both nonsensical and destructive to think of religion in competitive terms, turning it into something it can't be, it shouldn't be. It's first gift that we're talking about, an invitation. An invitation into that space I've described, where you stand together. Which is also why I think the religious perspective, the human perspective shaped by religious faith, is one in which we can't miss the point, we're often encouraged in this, we can't miss the point that some kinds of human good are necessarily and invariably social. There are some good things that you can only have together. And whether that's drainage systems or good parties or symphony orchestras, you know, those are inherently social goods. You can't have an individual good drainage system. You can't have an individual good symphony orchestra. Some things you have to collaborate to make good. Religious belief, partly because of all the things I've already been talking about, just puts that centre stage. The good that is my good alone is going to be an illusion. It's going to be a kind of category mistake. I shall get it wrong, and I'll get myself wrong, and I'll do myself damage in that process. And all the emphasis that's been put in the last couple of decades on the glory of individual choice has pushed us that little bit closer to thinking there's no such thing as a really social good. That, I think, again, needs saying pretty firmly and pretty repeatedly. Not because individual choice is an evil, but because if it's the only good you ever think about, it becomes an evil very, very quickly. And an occasion for more evil, it breeds. And it breeds division, clefts between people, and ultimately, with the gated community we've heard mentioned, a rather toxic social pattern in which proper interaction for the goods we might share becomes harder and harder to achieve. So, religious identity is something to do with that sustained conversation with the text in partnership. Something to do with coming into that space where relationships beyond competition open up. And all of this focuses, finally, some quite tough questions, which I'm very glad to have heard opened up so effectively by Josephine this afternoon, about what religious communities in general and Christian communities in particular, what we're educating people in and for. Do we think of it as part of the role of a healthy Christian community, a Christian school, a Christian parish, whatever, as shaping citizens? Not just, if you like, giving lessons in good citizenship, which is the easy way out and not particularly interesting, but do we see it in terms of shaping the sort of person who is going to be a real citizen, the sort of person who understands about shared goods, inherently social shared goods, the sort of person who understands that there's something prior to rivalry or something prior to commerce, the sort of person who might very well understand that the right place for economics is to be a good metaphor for other things, not to be the basic form of relationship. Is that what we're doing? I suspect the answer in 9 cases out of 10 in the life of the church, and even sadly in many of the church's educational institutions, is no, we're not very effectively. But it's not a bad time for asking why not and can we do better, which I take it as part of the agenda of today, part of the force of the excellent papers that we've had discussed here today. And of course it ought to be something which we as Christians should be locating very strongly in the context of our theology of church and Eucharist. The central identifying thing Christians have done since the New Testament period has been a shared activity, a shared social good, an act of charity, where people stand together in a common relationship to something they hadn't expected or asked for, as invited guests, together, all hungry, all needing what is to be given. More than that, it's an action in which your hunger being met isn't an individual thing, but something which takes you into a life that then triggers sharing in other contexts, meeting other people's hungers. And here we are, day after day and Sunday after Sunday, doing this extraordinary thing, or having this extraordinary thing done to us, which is the Eucharist. And yet, of course, so frequently, I'm as guilty as anybody, missing the point and not taking that step of saying, well, my hunger is met so that I can meet the hunger of others. So I think the question of what we educate people into as Christian believers is very closely bound up with how intelligently and fully and prayerfully we assimilate what the Eucharist is all about. I say that, of course, as somebody belonging very explicitly in a Eucharistic tradition. And I'm aware that there are Christian traditions around, one sitting in the front row there, for whom this is not historically the primary locus of identity or practice. And yet I think those traditions, whether it's the Salvation Army or the Society of Friends, those traditions are perhaps not founded at the centre of their identity, because they have so stressed, if you like, the other side of it, which is feeding the hunger, spiritual and actual, of people outside and around. We may have had the sacramental focus, we've been pretty dim at the outworking. Some Christian families have the outworking in abundance and haven't focused on the sacramental. Well, there's an interesting conversation to open up there, I suspect. But I don't think there's a fundamental disagreement about what's going on in discipleship in the church. You might want to talk more about that. So, I think that's most of what I want to say. But just one last thought to wind up, going back to government. I took very much to heart the challenge that came about government making us happy. I think actually that is one of the sad traps we may fall into in late modernity. It's to do with what Philip Bobbitt famously called the market state as the default position of modern politics. The state is there to give us what we want. The best form of politics would be a referendum, and everybody could say what they want and they'd count up the votes, and the people who got more votes would get what they wanted. It sounds a bit like democracy, but actually it's not, because it completely undercuts the idea that there is a common good at the end of the day, or so I believe. And that's why a campaign for real politics would perhaps get us back to a view of government that was both robust and quite modest. Robust in that it would grant that there was a moral dimension to our national life, that a society had to make some moral options. Moral options about how it treated the disadvantaged, moral options about how it treated the outsider, the refugee, or whoever. A government that never made any corporate moral options about those things would actually be a disaster. But modest, because we would be saying the point of government is not to make us either happy or good. The point of government is to balance where there is imbalance, to broker interests so that nobody grabs too much, to listen intelligently and patiently to different concerns and interests in a society, and weave those together in the most constructive way possible. And political disagreement, the difference between political parties, ought to be less about who's going to make us rich and happy quicker, and more about who has the deeper skill and the longer reach in this work of brokerage and balancing. Now, we are some way from that vision of politics, but the shock administered to the corporate system in the last few weeks and months does at least give us an opportunity for getting that question a bit more on the public agenda. What do we expect of government? Have we got to the point where we can't avoid going beyond that fantasy of government as what makes us happy and good? Can we be, in fact, a bit more grown up about government? I think that's what it comes down to. A big question. But it encourages me that, you know, we're here to address that sort of question, and here also in a spirit of willingness to address it with all those other communities of faith around us who have, I would say, much the same interest in challenging the glib versions of politics that are around at the moment. I hope that those relationships and that common commitment will perhaps begin to bring some change and some growth in the days ahead.